Welcome to Driven Radio Show, your home for car talk covering the latest news to the greatest views on the biggest names in performance, sports, and just plain cool driving machines. Let's rev up the conversation. Time for Driven Radio Show.
Hey, all you gearheads and car fiends, welcome to Driven Radio Show, your weekly automotive happy hour. I am Brett Hatfield here with my co-host and engineer extraordinaire, Mr. Mark Groves.
That's me.
We are coming to you from the rather chilly Driven Radio Studios.
What have you got this set to, beef?
I don't know, man. Jesus. You know, it was pretty comfortable upstairs. You come down to the studio and, well, I kind of wish I'd worn a thicker clothing.
Shirt? No, yeah. Kidding.
Well, you can tell. You can tell how much
it's
I like you.
It's making me cross-eyed.
Oh, that's disturbing. Okay, quickly, Mr. Mark.
Yeah.
Is your Dodge home yet?
Oh, no, it's dodging all right.
Your 1964
Dodge Custom 880, which, you know, look great, et cetera, great price, blah, blah, blah. But, poor Daryl. Daryl Ossipik at Ossipik Automotive in
Merriam, Kansas. Merriam, Kansas. 5920 Merriam Lane. I keep threatening him. I keep telling him, until you get my car back, I'm going to give everybody your phone number and just keep you buried.
Yeah, what he's going to do is my carburetor is going to be fixed with hate and rage.
Yeah, 913-831-3613.
So Daryl still got it because this is the weirdest thing. Basically, it doesn't run right because of the brakes. He got all the drums working. All of that's great.
Is this vacuum related?
Yeah. The booster that's on the backside of the master cylinder, and the booster shot.
Oh.
So he's trying to find that, and honest to God, you know, I should have expected this because it just went too easy when I got the car. I'm like, oh, okay, this is all cool. And then it kind of went to hell in a handbasket. But, you know, they have generic ones, but he's trying to find one where you don't have to cut a new plate and drill this and screw that and then, you know, pray that your
monkey
wrench.
He's trying to find one that fits properly.
Yeah. And that's really not happening. So
that's what you get for buying an oddball Mopar.
You're not wrong. Who knew? Anyway, obviously I didn't. So I've also got him kind of looking into the front disc brake conversion kits.
Oh, you wanted to go with like Wilwood or something?
Yeah, something that will work decently and that can be hooked up into the damn thing.
Let me tell you, after having had the 61 Impala that had front discs and rear drums, after a while I started wishing for four-wheel discs.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get on the brakes hard and it'll lock up the back. Fronts are great, but it would lock up the back on that. Of course, you know, with the 409, it was carrying all the weight over the nose anyway. So,
yeah, I don't have that problem.
What a surprise. Daryl's also been working on my 65 Stingray. He's got the wiring done. He's got the alternator in. He's got all that stuff done. And notice while he was doing it, it had eaten another ammeter for whatever reason.
Oh, my God.
So ordered another one. It's headed this way.
So basically, you've got an electric hibachi grill.
No, I got a 327 powered one. You just can't tell how hot it's going to get.
That'll harder.
Because we've got Daryl buried in classic stuff, I took my 02 F-150 Harley Edition over to the Ford dealer.
Yeah.
The rear differential makes a little noise.
How many miles does it have on that one?
15,000.
Oh, it's like it's brand new.
Just like new. AC was blowing a little lukewarm, so I figured, okay, well, it's probably never had any refrigerant added to it. So
yeah, and it doesn't have cool wing vents like my car. So.
No, I lost that when I got rid of the Bronco. Damn it. And the speedometer for some reason has always been off like 10%. It's weird. And I asked them to take a look at it and see if they could figure out how to fix it. And they called me this afternoon and said that it had been calibrated incorrectly from the factory.
Oh.
They had not at the factory set the correct rear gear ratio and tire and wheel height on it.
All right.
And when they tried to reprogram it, it fried the CPU.
Good. God,
it fried the computer on my truck, and they said they were having trouble finding another one for a 22-year-old pickup that's brand new.
How do you with her.
I don't know, man. I don't know, but I'll hand it to Aletha Ford. I got to give it to him. Not only did they call and tell me exactly what had happened when they tried to fix the problem, and they took full responsibility for it. And they said they'd pay for it.
Well, you know, Windows 98 was a little tweaky. So.
Well, and again, 15,000 miles on it. I don't drive it that much.
Yeah.
So they stood behind it, and they're taking responsibility for it. My hat's off to Aletha Ford. I knew their phone number. I'd give that sucker out too. Here's the funny thing: the Schadenfreude Chronicles that we've been updating it weekly.
Yeah,
everything on it works. Everything on the whole stinking car works. It runs like a champ, and I even got the stereo done with Bluetooth in it now, so I can listen to all the good music I got on my phone.
That's the most important part to a car. That's what I learned when I was a kid, that the most important thing stereo's is that it has a damn stereo.
Stereo's got to work well.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it isn't worth running right.
I was so stinking happy with a car that when I had it home this weekend, it's living in the garage now.
Yeah.
Because all my other stuff's broken and elsewhere. I had it in the garage over the weekend, Sunday I got a hair and just went through the whole car and did the full detail. I clay barred the body, did some defect correction on the paint, polished all the paint, then got inside, cleaned all the leather, conditioned all the leather, vacuumed everything out, wiped down the wood trim. I mean, I did everything to it. And so now it looks pretty damn good. Aside from the other cosmetic fixes it needs, but we're working on those. It's really turning out to be a nice car, and it always was before. So, we're well on our way to resurrecting her fully. Maybe eventually, I can get rid of the Schadenfreude name. I know better than that. That's never going away.
Hey,
never going away.
Knock on Formica, man.
Yeah. Well, my dad and I have had a running joke about that car for a long time. It's a $2,000 oil change, because while it's there, they're going to find something. And it'll be $2,000, so you're going to get stuck with it. Our special guest this week is Rick Shad. Rick is a seasoned professional artist based in Rhode Island. He has designed iconic t-shirts for clients like the Grateful Dead. Oh, I want one of those. And the White House, and innovated golf with the world's first divot tool equipped fashion belt. Rick's creative journey. I know. I got to ask. I want to know.
Yeah.
And then if he's got any left, I got to get one from my dad, because dad will dig it. Rick's creative journey led him through packaging design, toy design, and innovation at Hasbro, and creating representations of exclusive cars like Ayrton Senna's rookie Formula One car. Rick's passion culminated in co-creating the acclaimed Audrey Newport Concours and Motor Week. Now known as the Pope of Plastic, Rick captivates audiences worldwide on TikTok with his model building videos. He is routinely commissioned to build intricate and unique models for collectors and enthusiasts all over the world. Rick, welcome to Driven Radio.
Wow, thank you. Who do I need to pay for that? That was pretty good.
The bill's on its way. Don't worry. Okay, first things first, dude. You've got a belt that's got a divot tool in it?
Yeah. Well, I did. I mean, it was very, very popular. I was doing a lot of work in the golf industry, working with Golf Digest and some other folks. And while I was working with them, I loved golf. I still do. I don't play much anymore. But I was wearing a belt. A company wanted me to design some belts for a golf tournament, and I was wearing a belt. I'll never forget this. It was a Greg Norman belt, and it had a metal tip on the end of it. And I put my hand on the tip, and for some reason, it hit me like a bolt of lightning. And I said, man, you could put a divot tool in this thing. And if you know anything about golf, one of the biggest problems for greenskeepers is people, you know, hitting balls into the green and not fixing ball marks. So the product was actually really, really well received, and I ended up having PGA Tour players wear it on tour. It sold all over the world. It did really well. Unfortunately, I had two very horrible partners. So it ended up not working out so great for me, but it was a great experience, and I really got a great education on how branding works, how marketing works, how selling works, you know, into retail, because we were selling in Brooks Brothers and Nordstrom's. And so it was a very successful item. Just unfortunately, you know, you got to you got to be careful who you pick as your partner. So that would be a piece of advice I'd give people. And make sure you look at the books. That's another thing you might want to look
at. Yeah.
Sometimes 50-50 isn't 50.
No.
Well, you know, what is your next design going to be, like the little hanger on the belt? So with a gyroscope, so you can put a Mai Tai or Harvey Wallbanger in there and not have it tip?
I'm so happy you didn't go the ball washer route. I was really waiting for that.
No, I've heard it all.
The only thing I know about golf is cocktails.
I've been asked to put everything in belts. I'm out of the belt business now.
He learned his lesson.
Yeah.
How did you first get into cars, Rick? Did you have an early automotive influence?
Yeah, I did. I grew up in Southern Florida. I'm a true Floridian, but some of my family is from Timmonsville, South Carolina, including my cousin Cale Yarborough. So, early on watched NASCAR.
You buried the lead. Cale Yarborough is your cousin?
Yes, he's a cousin of mine. Oh, he's passed away now, sadly. Yeah. And he's from Timmonsville, South Carolina. So I have roots in it. I grew up watching racing and was a big fan of the Indianapolis 500 and just loved cars. As an artist, and I've always loved the look of cars and the art that is involved that goes into cars, and especially obviously the design process. And so I was hooked at an early age. I mean, I wrecked a lot of cars as a kid. I think two in 1 week when I got my, just before I got my driver's license, I backed my girlfriend's Volkswagen into a Corvette that had just come out of restoration. And then about 2 weeks later, I got my driver's license. My dad told me I couldn't go out of town, but where did I go? Out of town, decided to try to jump some railroad tracks and totaled that beautiful automobile, the Pontiac J2000.
That's okay. That needed to be totaled.
So I don't even think anybody's ever heard of that car.
I know what those are. Those were horrid. Those needed to. That was Pontiac's version of the Chevette, if memory serves.
Oh, it was terrible. Yeah, but anyway, I wrecked it. So.
Good. Well, you've done the world a favor.
Yeah. So I've had an affinity with the car my whole life. So I love cars, and I ultimately I was able to work in the industry. So
I'm sorry, I just found a picture of your J2000, and it really looks like late 70s, early 80s Firebird had sex with a Citation. The front end is like it.
Not even it, that good.
It's like an angry Monza. It's just
beautiful.
But you can put groceries in the back, so that's important.
Yeah, you could probably put a lot of things in the back. Most of them bad.
Yeah. All your dreams.
What was your first automotive related job?
First automotive related job. Well, let's say transportation related job was I was in Air Force fuels, refueling aircraft. So I used to drive fuel trucks on the flight line and refuel all the airplanes, you know, bombers and fighters and all that kind of stuff. So that was really my first automotive related job, was driving a fuel truck, but in the Air Force. But my first actual association with the industry was I was asked to sell Ayrton Senna's rookie car for a friend of mine that owned it in England, a guy named Graham Story, who used to do all the transportation for Formula One. And I was friendly with him, and he contacted me about helping him to sell the car. And because of my branding experience, I took the car and I treated it as a branding exercise, essentially, and did the development all around how this car, you know, the whole history of it. And I mean, people do this every day now, but back when I did it, it was, you know, most people weren't used to seeing like a true portfolio of a car, and it really made it look like something, you know, kind of like Sotheby's does now or RM, but really built this beautiful package and ultimately sold the car to Zach Brown, the CEO of McLaren. And it was from there I kind of started getting exposure in the industry, started selling some other cars for people, started helping some folks in racing to raise money, help them with developmental plans to, to get sponsorship and to, raise the money to go racing, all doing it, as with my expertise in branding. So, a presentation when you're looking or asking for somebody for, millions of dollars is very, very important, to be able to tell the story. And ultimately I'm a storyteller from a branding perspective. Or a product perspective. So I would build these presentations for people, and I would also get to go to a lot of the car events with these folks. And I started coming up with the idea to build, a major car event here in Rhode Island. So I was kind of consulted with people, really.
Now we're going to get to your car event in Rhode Island real quick. But when you sold that, was that prior to Senna's passing? He's been gone 30 years this week.
Oh yeah, no, it was. I'm trying to think of the exact year. I would say it was 2015, I think.
Oh, so this is fairly recently.
Yeah, it was fairly recent. Actually, Zach became the CEO the day that he bought the car.
Oh wow, wow! Nice, nice present to yourself.
Better than a watch.
I was with him when he got the car, and he said, "Hey, I became the CEO of McLaren." So I was like, "Oh, that's pretty interesting."
What was your first artistic job?
My first artistic job was designing T-shirts for. Really for the screen printing industry way back in high school. I did t-shirts for the I was a big surfer, competitive surfer back in the day, and I would design all the t-shirts for all the contests, and I was really good at it. And after I got out of the Air Force, I was going to go to college, but I found a job designing t-shirts for a sporting goods company, and he was like, "Man, you're really, really good at this." And I kept getting better, so I started working for bigger companies designing T-shirts. And what you might know about designing T-shirts is it may sound, goofy, like I'm in a mall or something, but it is a huge, huge industry. And if you can design artwork for T-shirts, number one, you have to be a really good designer. Number two, it teaches you production art, which makes you very valuable in the art world. So you learn a lot about color, how colors work together, how the production has to be set up to produce the image on a shirt. And it really gave me really good fundamentals to move on from T-shirts into packaging design, from packaging design to product design, from product design to art directing, from art directing to creative directing, and so on and so forth. So T-shirt design is where I got my start, and that laid the foundation for everything else.
I don't mean to get off topic, but how does a competitive surfer wind up in the Air Force?
Here's the story. It's a good one. How long is this show? Is this like 4 hours?
It's as long as we want.
I can boil it down. It was jail or that.
No. What it was, here's what it was. I got caught jumping
a car.
Yeah. Over railroad tracks.
I was always an artist. I can always remember. I mean, that was what I was kind of born to do. And my mom pushed me to be an artist. And when I was in high school, Parsons School of Design invited me to join their summer program. And I went to Parsons School of Design, New York City summer program. And they were going to offer me a scholarship. And when I got back to Florida, it was my senior year, and I was like, "Man, I can't wait to go to New York." And after spending all my dad's money every summer partying and never learning anything, my dad said, "You're not going to New York to go to art school. I don't give a crap what you do. You can go to community college. You can go to a school in Florida, but you're not going to New York." So what did I do? I went to a recruiter to show him a thing or two. My dad was the happiest person I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
And when that sergeant came to our house, my dad, I've never seen, to this day, seen my dad happier than his son was going to the Air Force.
Well, yeah. Hey, They'll clothe him. They'll feed him. They'll give him a job. They'll give him a place to live. They'll get him out of my hair. Yeah, I'm quite sure your old man was thrilled to death.
He left a boy. He came back a man.
My mom was crying and my dad was jumping for joy.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail the interview, but I'm sitting here scratching my head thinking, he's a surfer. How the hell did he wind up in the military? That doesn't work. What's the toughest part of mixing cars and art?
You know, I don't think there's a tough part except for if you're doing stuff like if I build a model for a car collector. Car collectors are some of the pickiest, big-headed, jerks on the planet, most of them. But
I resemble that remark. Yeah, I resemble that remark.
They're all 100% wonderful. I love them.
There you go. But, in this room.
But probably the hardest, because I build for people that that it means something to them. So they want it to be exact. So that's a demanding thing. But I'm very good at dealing with those people. My whole life as an artist has been working and producing for other people. So I'm used to taking criticism. I'm used to, making the customer happy. But the challenge is meeting the customer's need. But there, as far as the art goes, there is no real challenge. I mean, whether I'm designing for the car world, the military world, for the toy world, to me, it's kind of all the same because it's a creative process. And for me, the art is, no matter what it is, I can kind of see the art in all of it. And that's I apply myself the same way, whether it's cars or anything else.
Okay. Last shirt related question. You said you wound up getting pretty good at it and designing for bigger and bigger companies. Have you done stuff that we would recognize?
If you like rock and roll music, then you surely have. I've done a lot of, and I still do. I actually still do design some t-shirts for one company only. And that's a company called Sick Boy Motorcycles. And I've been his designer for 25 years, and he ends up doing the t-shirts for a lot of the rock and roll musicians. So if you see somebody like Michael Anthony from Van Halen, anytime you see him wearing a t-shirt, 90% chances it's something I designed. If you see Kenny Aronoff, the world famous drummer, who's one of my closest friends, he's always wearing my stuff. You know, people like Sammy Hagar, you got people from the guys in Guns N' Roses to Glenn Hughes, from Deep Purple to, so if you see a musician, a lot of these rock musicians wear my stuff. So you've certainly seen my stuff, most likely, if you like music.
Very good. Couple of audiophiles here. So, how did you wind up working, for the Audran Museum, and what was your role there?
Well, that's another interesting story. I had been going to these car shows, as I alluded to earlier, Pebble Beach and all these different events. And I live in Rhode Island, and we have Newport, Rhode Island, which is one of the most beautiful places in the United States.
It's I'm guessing like the surfing in Rhode Island is brisk.
Surfing is a little cold.
Yes,
just a touch.
We invented the banana in the pants because it shrivels up so much. I would go to these shows and I was like, I'm thinking to myself now, I'm like, why don't we have a big show, like Pebble Beach in Rhode Island? That's what I was going through my head. So I'm the kind of guy that if you don't put the idea down on paper, it never happens, and I'm very good at doing presentations. So if I really like the idea, I'll go ahead and do a presentation for it. So I came up with the idea. I wrote it out. And after I wrote it out, I talked to some people about it. And they were like, wow, this is a great idea. You should pursue this. So I built a presentation. And the presentation looked like the event had already happened. So I happened to be at a shop and, talking to people, different car people. And I went to a car show and the Audran Museum was there. And I talked to a girl there and I said, hey, I have this idea for a car show. I might, I'd be interested in talking to you all about maybe being involved or using your facility, or because they were right in Newport. She said, well, why don't you come down and talk to us and show us your presentation? So I went down there and I think I was halfway through the presentation, showing it to the girls in the office, essentially. And the founder of Audrain, Nick Schorsch, came in and he said, what is this? And they were like, oh, this is Rick Shad. This is his idea for a motor week in Newport. And he looked through the presentation. He looked at me and he said, this is something I've always wanted to do as well. And he said, why don't we do it together? And I said, okay.
Sure.
So, I mean, that after that conversation, it probably was another 3 months before him and I really sat down, and I didn't think that anything would really happen because I, you know, talk to people all the time that have money and they get involved in other things and, you know, they forget about it. But he was truly interested, and I went back to talk to him and he said, let's do it together. You can build it, you know, I'll essentially, you know, fund it. And that was it. I was hired as executive director to build it. And while I was there building it from 2017 to 2019, it went from just me essentially to, you know, building a staff and working with the museum. And while I was there, I ended up becoming executive director of the museum as well. And we spent 3 years building the event, and I pretty much did every aspect of it. I designed the logo, I designed the trophy, I designed the signage, I helped get all the sponsors. I introduced John Legend at the concert, negotiated his contract, and so it was quite the journey that a lot of people said I couldn't do, and it wouldn't be successful. It wouldn't. Doing a car show, you know, like this is too hard. And I heard all of the excuses, but at the end of the day, in October of 2019, we pulled off one of the greatest car events that's ever happened in the United States. And Sandra Button herself, who was there as a judge, told me, she said, this is as good as Pebble Beach. And I appreciate the opportunity to do what I did there. I learned an immense amount. I met a lot of wonderful people. I was able to build a really good name for myself. I think I left there very, very respected. And I think I did a hell of a job.
Having earned the moniker Pope of Plastic for your model building skills, how long have you been building model cars, planes, boats, et cetera? And do you happen to recall your very first?
I do. I've been building models. I started building models when I was a kid. Built them growing up and then took a big break as I went through life. But I always thought about models. I always loved models. It was something I always wanted to get back into at some point. My very first model was in 1975. It was a Revell submarine that my mom gave my babysitter $5 and said I could go to the convenience store and I could pick something out. And my brother was a great model builder, and I used to envy his model builds and watch him build models. So I went to the convenience store, I bought this submarine, I took it home, and it was, from what I can remember, it was a complete disaster. I got really upset building it, which still happens to this day. I'm kind of famous for it. Submarine was my very first model.
And did it go in the bathtub when you were done?
I don't think it made it, even though the model was essentially two halves. I don't think the two halves actually made it together.
I don't know if people, you know, as we talk about this, you're building these models. I'm looking at Rick's Bespoke Models. There's an Alfa Romeo 8C Monza 1/12 scale.
Yeah.
That... You know, I built an S ton of models when I was a kid, but Jeebus Chrysler, the amount of detail on this is almost annoying in just how freaking incredible it is. I mean, Jesus Christ. Let's use this as the example. It's on rickbespokemodels.myportfolio.com. So wow. rickbespokemodels.com. How long does it take for you to
first
do a build
of all
like
it's
this?
1/12 scale, that's a big one.
Yeah, most are 1/24 scale, the old model ones that like I used to build.
Yeah.
And secondly, that looks like it is fresh from a racetrack.
Yeah.
Right.
If that I didn't know fantastic. It was dinky, I would be like, my God, how did you fit an entire engine onto a piece of paper? This is hell.
Oh, I'm looking through this and all the paintwork you did with the patina and everything before assembly. Jeez, Rick. This is...
So how long did this take, this one?
That took, I think, about probably 150 hours to do that.
Look at the distributor on that.
150 yeah. hours.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I get it. You're the Pope. God bless. Look at that thing. That's fantastic.
Even the seat, that looks like real leather. It looks
it
real.
Probably okay. is.
Yes. I did the seat from scratch, actually. So.
Ah. Well, how do you get this kind of patina and there's a roughness to some of the paint that is just pure period? What do you do? I mean, what is your process?
This I'm seriously curious
because this is
gorgeous. It's really hard to explain the process because there's a lot that goes into it.
Did you hand paint those gauges?
Yes.
Yeah. Holy cow! Look at that. That's awesome. Hey, you got better eyes than I do, dude.
The floor is actual metal, so.
I wondered because it looks so freaking real.
So first off, I'm probably most well known for weathering. And making things look real through weathering. It's a complicated process, and it's almost different every time. There's a base that you do. I'll start with a wash, okay, essentially. So I'll mix alcohol, acrylic, to kind of, depending on where it raced, where it was in the world, I study those kind of things. I know what the mud looks like. I know what the track condition looks like. So... in my mind, I'm kind of painting a picture of how I want. It's like an oil painting.
Yeah.
And I start with layers. So I start with I paint the car beautifully. A lot of the times I weather as I go. But if I'm weathering a car that's kind of been finished, I start with a wash. And that wash is usually my base for whatever I'm doing. On top of that wash, once it is dry, I go in with chalk pastels,
yes.
which emulate what a car actually goes through, because the sand and dirt and dust is a dry or wet pigment, essentially. So I'll go in and I will dry brush in all of, any of the mud, the dirt, rust, all those different types of things. Once I do that, then it is affixed with hairspray, with Aquanet hairspray. Once I spray down the hairspray, then I will go back and I will do dry brushing to bring out highlights out of certain metal components that I want that you would see kind of poking through because they've been worn, by the wind or water or whatever. And then I just keep repeating that process until I get, but it's in the bottom line, it's all about layering color to trick somebody into thinking it is real.
Yeah.
And that is where the art comes in. And it's one of those things that, just because you can build a model doesn't mean that you can do all the effects to make it look real. It's like me telling you okay, well, I'm Rembrandt, and you're going to watch me. And just because you watch me paint and because I'm Rembrandt, you're going to be Rembrandt. It's one of those things that's the part you're kind of born with, understanding color, understanding color theory, and being able to have those pictures mentally in your mind, and then being able to have that picture to be able to replicate what's in your mind. That's a very difficult thing to do. It's not difficult for me because I do it every day and I understand it, but for somebody who doesn't know that, it can be kind of challenging. A lot of people tend to overdo it,
I'm looking through the other stuff you've built on your website, Rick, and this is just breathtaking. They are fantastic. When you're finished with these, do you sell them?
I only work on commission. So every model that you see, I'm building for somebody. And every model that you see has a unique story to somebody. I'm usually most of the time hired to replicate a memory, for somebody, whether their grandfather raced that Alpha or I flew this helicopter in Iraq and they want that helicopter, you know, that they flew, and they want it exactly like they remember it. So I'm recreating memories is what I'm doing for people. So I don't keep any models. I think I have one here, and it's for my brother, and he lives in Australia, and I refuse to send it unless he pays the shipping. So
what is it? Maybe we can come to terms.
A10. It's right here. Here you go. It's an A10 Warthog.
Oh, sweet. Cool. Very cool.
I always thought those were kind of interesting looking, but then I went to an air show and it was Silent coming in and kicking my ass on the way out. And I'm like, ah, ha, ha.
Those things are incredible.
My dad worked for Lockheed and for McDonnell Douglas back in the late 60s. And he helped build the first C-5A that ever went out.
Oh,
and
he
was also a sheet metal worker for a lot of the F-4 Phantoms.
When they were flying the, I'm sorry, this is an aside. When they were flying the C-5As into Gardner and sticking the Chinooks in them, did you go out there and take a look at them?
Oh, no.
The tail on the C-5A was as tall as the tower is over at Industrial.
We've got a picture from Marietta, Georgia, or it might have been Atlanta's newspaper in 1968. The first C-5A to, you know, roll off the assembly line. They brought all the workers out and their families.
And put them inside.
And we got to take a tour, and there's a shot of the tail is up, and there's this whole crowd of people. And my mom, of course, because she, if you had a memorabilia type thing like that, she had no problem circling it and inking on it.
Yeah.
And she, of course, circled our faces all down there in the crowd, but you can't miss us. And it's all there. And I, even in my garage, I have my dad, he got a framed print that was not well taken care of. But of the C-5A with a thank you from, I think it was Lockheed, wasn't it? For all the workers who put in efforts on making that happen. So,
yeah. Oh, man, you've even got a moon lander.
Yeah, I got to fly on it a bunch of times.
Oh, did you? God, it must be like being in a seasick city because the thing's just so huge.
We played football in the back over the Atlanta.
That's awesome.
Okay, that's excellent.
I love it.
Now, that was a C-5A or a C-5B?
It was 1988, so it would have been a later version.
Wow, that's pretty awesome.
So you said that all the models you build are on commission. What's involved when someone commissions you to build a custom model? Are you starting with an existing model kit and customizing it from there?
Yeah, the way that it works is people see me build live pretty much every day, so I get contacted, and the way it works is most of the time they purchase a kit. I tell them what kit to buy. They purchase the kit, they send the kit to me, and then I build the kit. They need to provide me with photograph if they want me to do it exactly like, say, an airplane that their grandfather flew in. I need as many photographs as I can get. I need what the nose art looked like so I can recreate it. I have to get the tail numbers. I get as much as I can get from them. I build a PDF from that. I do my own research. I build a PDF file. And then a lot of the times the models aren't good enough for what I want to do. So I'm scratch building, say, the wiring. Or, you know, it may have some certain things in it that I don't like that the kit has. So I'm rebuilding, you know, those parts. So I'm taking an existing kit and adding on it. But I mean, because most of these days, I mean, you can pretty much find a kit at just about anything. So there's no real reason for me to reinvent the wheel, you know. But so it's usually the kit is a starting point for me. And then it's everything that goes on top of that, especially all the painting, you know, that goes into it. But I'm building my models extremely detailed. So I'm doing the engines, I'm doing the, you know, as much wiring, anything that you can see that you can open up and see, I'm essentially doing. So, but then, yeah, so we agree on a price. I give them a quote of how much it's going to be. And, you know, I require a 50% deposit because I'm spending so many hours. If somebody backs out at the end, you know, what am I going to do with, you know, whatever it is, you know, so I have to cover myself on, you know, on, you know, and so, you know, most of it. I have to be covered so I can work on it. So, but I don't have any problem. I've never let down a customer. I don't have any problem finding customers now. I get contacted all the time. I can always use more. I mean, I'm this is what I'm doing for a living, so I need to get more commission. So, but I'm pretty popular, so I get contacted all the time. I get to do all sorts of different stuff, from cars to boats to planes to helicopters. I just did 3 trains for somebody. I did motorcycles. I do, you name it, I do it. Whatever somebody wants done, I'll do it for them.
And if every build is bespoke, there's probably no typical build, but I'm curious, what does the average build sell for? This sounds like it's really involved and you've got hundreds of hours in these.
Mm-hmm. They're not, I mean, if I truly charged like for my design, what I get for building a Concorde or something and tried to do it, you know, for that hourly rate, nobody would ever be able to afford, you know, the model. So I have to be realistic. Part of it is enjoyment for me, so I have to weigh that in. And then it's usually based on around $40 an hour. And so if a model takes me, if you say a 1/32nd scale aircraft, you can count on at least 100 hours. So whatever 100 times 40 bucks is, I mean,
four that's grand.
Essentially plus the cost of the kit and plus shipping, yeah. So $4,000, yeah.
But
I'll do smaller kits. It also depends on the size. I build so much that I can build fairly quickly now and still achieve the same level of detail. I've just honed my skills so much that I can build not on autopilot, but as long as I know the plan and I know what I'm doing, I can go through my process and build fairly quickly. It's kind of interesting. I build big models during the week, and then on the weekends, for my fans that really can't afford the expensive models, I'll build one small model every weekend. And those are the ones usually that somebody, they're under $1,000. So a lot of people can afford those. So I'll do one small one on the weekend, and sometimes I auction them off on a Sunday. And, you know, you can get a good deal on one of my models on a Sunday. And then also, I run a contest on TikTok. Actually, I have one tonight at the end of the first of every month. If you're a subscriber, if you actually are paying money, I have subscribers that pay money to watch me. You get into a drawing in order to win a model from me every month, and that's a smaller model. And I build everything live. I'm watched from start to finish every single model that I do. So wow. The customer gets to see me build their model.
Yeah, but you also work in a fishbowl.
I do work in a fishbowl.
Everybody gets to see what you're doing.
Oh, believe me. And I don't hold back. I mean, they see me get mad. They see me throw things. They see me. They love it. The more mad I get, the more the viewership goes up. They just,
that's
my God.
That's hilarious.
They absolutely love it. So I got to tell you, I'm getting ready to do a thing called the F-Bomb Marathon. And the F-Bomb Marathon is that. So the F-Bomb Marathon is on Sunday. This Sunday, you can watch me build a model from start to finish without taking a break.
Oh, boy.
Okay? So the F-Bombs usually start early as I'm working. But this is going to be, it's going to build. The F-bombs are going to build until I get.
He's going to be shock and awe.
That's why it's called the F-bomb marathon. So.
So I imagine you probably get some of your supplies from model shops or associated businesses, but you're doing such detailed stuff. Where do you, are you making some of what you use? Are you buying it? Are you using stuff that most people wouldn't consider? Where are you getting your stuff?
Wherever, I'm always keeping my app. Most of my detail stuff, I do not buy at a hobby shop. Most of it is stuff that I find, you know, could be anywhere and I could look and go, oh my God, that would be the perfect hose for a MiG fighter, you know, from the Cold Era. You know, that could be, you know, that's a perfect hydraulic line for a B-17. That looks perfect. That's a beautiful Mercedes, you know, air hose. You know, So I'm always looking, no matter where I am. It could be a garage sale. It could be at a dollar store. It could be, I mean, I love the dollar store. I find stuff in the dollar store all the time. But I don't tend to buy this stuff from the hobby stores. And I don't, funny enough, and it's not because, oh, I'm better than anybody. It's, I don't like watching anybody else build. So I don't pick. And the reason I don't like it is because I like figuring everything out myself. And that's what, to me, makes my model special. And I hear it all the time when people are watching you, they're always commenting and you know, giving you suggestions. And they say, oh, why don't you do it that way? Well, you know, so-and-so does it this way. There's an easier way to do that. I'm really not interested in that stuff because I love the learning process. I love trying to figure out how to make metal look real and how do you use real metal, or, you know, how do I create great, you know, disc brakes for a car, you know? And I don't use really any 3D printing unless the kit, you know, comes with some 3D printed parts. I like doing stuff by hand. And I like finding, you know, found items, you know, that I can turn into something that looks accurate in miniature, you know, and that, to me, that's the fun of it. That's what keeps it interesting for me.
Very cool. You know, you're building all your stuff live on TikTok. How big is your audience?
Right now, I just reached 8,000. But TikTok's a little different than, you know, than Instagram, or, you know, 8,000 maybe on some other platforms doesn't sound like a lot, but on, I have 8,000 very active people. You know, the people that follow me are extremely active. I have people that watch me, the same people have been watching me every day for a year, have not missed a build that I do. They treat it almost like a TV series, and they come in, they know I'm on reliably every day at certain times, and they all come in at the same time. A lot of these people, I've really built a community, and the people really have become friends with each other. They're very supportive of not only of me, but other people in this group. It's one of the most positive, it's one of the most positive things I've ever experienced in any social media platform. So when I hear stuff about TikTok, and, you know, I don't believe a lot of it because I'm actually on it every day. And yeah, there can be negativity on any platform. I can honestly say that in over almost 2 years that I've been on TikTok, I have had maybe two negative comments the entire time I've been on. I've had nothing but overwhelming support. The love in my community is just astounding. You know, the things that they've done for me, and, you know, I don't have to buy supplies anymore. A lot of these guys pay for my paints and pay for my glue. They order kits from me. Pretty much every day somebody sends me a model kit, you know, just out of the blue, just because they like seeing me unbox a model live on TikTok and talk about it and give my opinion on it. And then they're hoping that I'll build it one day. And it's just an incredible, I can honestly say, this is going to sound stupid, but TikTok changed my life. It really did. And for the better. It made me a better person. It's made me a lot more tolerant, you know.
Well, the people grateful. Who are watching this Sunday hope not.
It's that OnlyFans site, though, that's the issue.
Uh-huh. So, you know, I don't talk about that one all the time. But
it has to do with models, but, you know, it's
different kind of modeling.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it's been a wonderful thing, and it's really you know, I'll be honest with you, when I Audrain and all of that ended, I did go build a couple of the car events out at M1 Concours in Pontiac, Michigan. But I was in a pretty deep depression, and that was when I decided to build models again. And when I started building models, I needed to have something positive in my life to do.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I should start building models again. And I started to, and then my friend of mine suggested I should go on TikTok and do it. And I was like, TikTok? I was like, I don't own a cat. I don't do makeup tips. I don't dance. You know, he was like, no, he's like, they'll love watching you. Because it's all video. They'll love watching you build a model. And sure enough, I went on there, and like in the first month, I had 1,000, you know, maybe 1,000 followers. I was able to go live. Then I started going live, and people started to, you know, get to know me, and they got to understand the idea behind the Pope of Plastic and what it, you know, what it's all about. And it's turned into my own brand. Most people on TikTok do not know my real name. They only know me as the Pope of Plastic.
That's who I am. Nice. That's still cool. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is when somebody subscribes, which means they're paying money, and I probably get a subscriber every day. I have a special papal chair that I pull out, and then I put on this very hat right here.
Oh, God.
Oh, look, and, he's got a mitre.
Oh, my God.
And I do a whole ceremony for them, and I anoint them as a bishop in the Cathedral of Model Building.
Oh, that's cool.
And I give them, you know, with the task of spreading the good word of creativity and bringing people together, white, black, brown, purple, yellow, gay, straight, doesn't matter, bringing people just for the love of creativity.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, people, and then I have a theme song that I play for them, and they love it. People will subscribe to get the ceremony.
I'm hooked. You know. I'm hooked. I'm ready to do this. This is cool.
You're like the nicest cult leader I've ever met.
Oh, it's
that's awesome.
It's a friendly, happy cult. Well,
yeah, that's a
you missed it last Saturday because I did my first annual Pope of Plastic Awards, where I gave out awards to people in the community, and we did it like the Academy Awards, and I had my own, you know, theme song written. I gave out what we call the golden peepee, which is the golden Pope of Plastic, which is my head. And I had, you know, 12 different categories, and I had people tuning in from around the world to watch this award show.
Oh, my
And it was just great.
And clearly it makes you miserable.
Dude knows how to theme a party. Holy cow.
That's awesome.
Terrible.
How would you recommend getting kids involved in model building?
Well, a big part of what I do, and the whole reason I started doing the TikTok thing in the beginning, was to try to get people exposed to the hobby and showing them that it's fun. You know, it's I think it's cool, you know, and gets them off the computer and, you know, gets them doing something with their hands and being creative. And I've had a lot of parents that come in and watch me who drag their kids in to watch me build models, and they ultimately end up building a model as a family, you know, a father, son. I've got a lot of girls, you know, women that watch me, and I have, you'd be amazed at the mail that I get, you know, the messages I get on a daily basis about how I've helped change their life, you know, through model building, how they hadn't built in years. They were in a deep depression. They were drinking. They were, you know, and they decided to build a model because they stumbled across me, and now they're sober and they've rediscovered something that they lost when they were a child, or they never thought about building a model, and now they're building a model. And it's the same way with the kids that come in, and I think it's, you know, what I do looks really cool, and they like watching it, and they want to try to do what I do. But I think the big thing is that they see that I'm having fun. Do I cuss and throw things? Yes. But most of the time I'm playing music, I'm singing, I'm making, you know, I'm making fun of what I'm doing. You know, I'm making fun of the people who wrote the instructions for the, you know, for the model kit. I come up with nicknames for all these people, like the guy in China that makes the directions for one of the companies. I call him Mr. Wong, and I yell at Mr. Wong, and, you know, so it's, you know, there's a lot of fun things that I do. So I show people that, you know, you can have fun doing something that is very positive. I mean, I won't go too detail, but I mean, I was, you know, I had a drinking problem for a long time, and alcohol was ruined my life for a big portion of it. And model building, if you're struggling with addiction or anything like that, you have to have something positive to replace in place of that bad thing.
Yeah.
And for me, that's model building. And I talk a lot about that every day when I'm building. I'm not ashamed to talk about it. And I think I'm relatable in some way to a lot of people. So it's, you know, it's just a very positive thing. And
it's the model glue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the model glue.
Yeah, I picked a bad day to quit sniffing glue.
Model glue.
Now, actually, I have a serious and not stupid remark question. Speaking of model glue, and then you can get back to whatever you're doing, because this is all right. What kind of glues do you use? Because like those citrusy smelling safe ones for everybody, you couldn't stick a thought together with those. No. I hate that. Well, but the stuff that, you know, in the 70s we used to do bad things with doesn't seem to exist much anymore.
Oh man, that's a shame.
It does. It's a loss.
No, it does. It does. It does exist. And I still use the same, essentially the same glue we used in the 70s.
Really?
That's one type of glue. I use that type of glue that used as a kid for kind of just kind of all around affixing things. But then you use what we call CA glues, which are super glues. And a CA glue is super glue. So there's a lot of parts like metal that has to go to plastic.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to use a super glue or a two-part epoxy to do that. And then we're using, this is a miracle, this Tamiya Thin. Okay. Tamiya Thin is almost like water, if you can see that. I mean, it's like a water. And what that does is if you have plastic that isn't painted, so if you're putting, fuselage halves together on an aircraft, you're not going to paint it until you get everything together. So what you take parts that aren't painted, you put them together, and you just take this paintbrush with this glue and you just paint it over it, and it chemically melts the two pieces together. So we use that type of glue. Then we use some acrylic glues that won't fog a glass.
Nice.
There's a bunch of different glues. I probably use six different glues depending on every build. So I use different glues for different things. Glues that dry fast, glues that dry slow, glues that, you know, and I have a video on my TikTok. If anybody goes to my TikTok at the Pope of Plastic, I have one video that's pinned in the very beginning of if you go to my page, and I think it's the second video, and it's all about, it says, Pope, what glue do you use? And it's a whole video.
There you go.
Okay, I'll have to go watch that. Because when I was a kid, I used one glue and always too much of it.
Yeah. Oh,
always.
You're not the only always. One. There's a reason that...
You can tell it's my model because my fingerprint's on it.
There's a reason that my entire year's worth of inventory of models all went up. It was all sacrificed on the 4th of July.
Oh, God.
And, man... We had more fiery car crashes and wrecks. Yeah, every one of those suckers. I saved one blazer for a couple of years because I didn't have any thumbprints on the outside of it, but the rest of everything got burnt.
Mine was almost a similar thing. I sold all of my models my first year of college.
You suckered somebody into paying for yours.
Well, this guy, he worked with my mom, and he was a nice fella. wasn't the sharpest tool in the model shed.
He bought your stuff,
but he bought this mass amount of models, and I'm like, I'm all done with them anyway. And about 8 months later, his apartment caught fire.
So they burnt too.
Every one of them.
All the evidence is gone. I'm looking at one of the F-104 Starfighters you did. And I was looking at the great detail you've got in it, and I noticed there's an Evans Speed Shop sticker on the fuselage or on the cockpit. Is there an in joke there? I want to know what that.
Yes, there is. Because my son is named Evan.
Okay.
So I tend to hide little things on models as I build them, and so I put the Evans Speed Shop on the windshield there on that F-104. But yeah, I always do little things like that with my models. I hide things. Now I have little Pope stickers. I'll put them in the rear window and stuff
that. I'm looking at this, and this is the one that's got the tail section off of it, and the detail is incredible, Rick. What an eye you've got. And this is fantastic. I'm extremely impressed.
Well, the thing
you
may not know about that model, if you look, is all metal.
Yeah.
That's not paint.
No, it looks like it's got brush marks in it, and it looks, man, you did a great job. I'm looking at The wiring.
Every panel. Every panel is hand cut aluminum.
Well, that's a gorgeous model.
That's nice.
And that does have really fantastic detail. I'm really, really impressed by that. Okay, Rick. Well, time for the final question. It's the one that everybody gets. And it's our favorite here. What is the dumbest thing you've ever done in a car?
Yeah, a real one.
I can say legally.
Okay, if he didn't kill anybody, chances are statute of limitations has run out.
The coolest thing that I've done in a car.
No, dumbest thing. Dumbest.
Well, don't try to change the flavor of the soda, baby. Right? Not in the middle of the drink.
Hey, wait. A lot of times, those are one and the same.
The dumbest thing I did in a car was when I was in the Air Force in England, and I came back for my brother's wedding, and I got in the car, and I went out to help somebody move some furniture, and I came back, and I was driving on the wrong side of the road, and I had a head-on car crash.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Blame it on Britain.
Oh, were you hurt? Was the other person hurt?
I was minorly hurt. She was not too seriously hurt. She was driving a Mercedes-Benz.
Okay.
What is it? 280 SL or the small convertible.
Okay.
And it was just at dusk. So, and I was just so used to driving them because on the bases, you drive American cars, you know, on the British side. So when I came over, I was used to driving an American car on the other, you know, on the British side. So when I came over, it was only the day after I'd been in the United States and driving on the wrong side of the road and hit her head on.
Oh, no. What were you in?
I was in another beautiful gold Toyota Corolla four door. It was gorgeous. A 1986 Toyota Corolla. It's a shame.
Wow, a truly fine vehicle. I'm guessing the Toyota didn't live to talk about it again.
I don't think so.
But my dad drove to the accident scene. I could see him when he got his car with his hands on his head. And I destroyed another car. It was like, I just paid for the J2000. Now it's the Toyota Corolla.
Oh, and I goofed that up. The J2000 was not Pontiac's version of the Chevette. That was the T1000. I got the two confused. The J2000 was, Citation-ish sort of looking. Yeah.
Monza-ish.
Fabulous vehicle.
Doc, it's a looker.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Rick Shad, the Pope of Plastic.
Pope of Plastic!
Rick, please tell us where we can find you online and on social media.
Well, number one, find me on TikTok, at the Pope of Plastic. Don't be scared of TikTok, for crying out loud. Nothing going to hurt you. I'm on Instagram at the Pope of Plastic. You can find me on LinkedIn, Rick Shad, RickSchad. Email me, thepopeofplastic@gmail.com. If you're interested in having me build a model for you, I'd love to do it. And check me out every day, building live. Watch me throw F-bombs.
F-bombs aside, Rick, outstanding craftsmanship. Yeah, I'm really, truly impressed with this. I gotta go shake my piggy bank, see if I can afford to have something made.
I know. I'm looking at all this going 56 Plymouth, 65, you know, Merc.
Oh, no. I was looking at the 55 Mercedes Gullwing.
Oh, that thing. Yeah. Right up your alley.
Yeah, just a little bit. Rick, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. And man, what outstanding work. Everybody, go check him out. Pope of Plastic everywhere. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys. You guys are awesome. I enjoyed it so much.
For everybody, and now, granted, this is still an audio presentation. It's still strictly an audio medium. But we're going to have pictures when we post all the social media. Everybody needs to go check out Rick's website. Now, he had one at imodeler.com/author/RickShad, RickSchad, and see all the stuff he's done. And he's also got another website, Rick's Bespoke Models, Just go check out either one. You cannot believe the craftsmanship on this.
Yeah, it's a little embarrassing just how much I'm nerding out on this, because I we're not blowing smoke. His build skills and his eye for capturing the real essence is amazing.
Well,
they look real.
That alpha, the first thing we saw, is so impressive. The thing looks like it's fresh from a race on a dirt track or a dirty track, and it looks like it just came off the racetrack. The patina and the dirt and it is so cool. The job he did on that
looks real,
and everything else, you know, every other model he's done looks real. They don't look like models, man.
No.
And the attention to detail is astounding. So definitely check that out. And Rick, thank you so much for being with us. He took a ton of time with us.
Yeah.
And really explained everything he did.
I didn't think we'd be talking this long with him, to be quite honest.
No, I really didn't either. When we were, when I was looking at this interview and I was writing out the questions and everything, I'm thinking, God, I hope we get a half hour out of this.
Yeah, this, you know, it's cool and everything, but I did it. And then we got to talking and it's like, oh my God, there's some real stuff.
And we talked to him for a long time after the interview.
Yeah, after the mics were off, it's like, oh, hey, dude, how about that? And then we went on and on, and it was cool. He's a cool, what a nice guy.
Yeah, and we started getting a little chummy. Hey, would you like to meet my sister?
what kind of curtains do you like?
That kind of stuff. Thank you so much for spending time with Driven Radio. We love what we do, and we wouldn't be able to do it without the support of our listeners. You can find us online at drivenradioshow.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Driven Radio Show, and on LinkedIn as the Driven Radio Show podcast. We have discovered that the download numbers that we are reported from our provider only represent a small fraction of the listens the show actually gets, and the streaming numbers aren't included in the count. And in addition to that, iTunes doesn't report a damn thing. Not nothing. So if you're listening to us, please do us a small favor and download the show so we can have a more accurate idea who all is in the audience. If you have a story you would like to tell or someone you would like us to interview, please contact me at brett@drivenradioshow.com. I am Brett Hatfield for Mark L. Groves.
Yo.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time here on Driven Radio.